years.
Hi, everybody. My name's Polly, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. When I got here yesterday, I want to set the record straight. When I got here yesterday, I was approached with, somehow or another, it had gotten around that I was terminally ill. And the diseases that are flying around that I had are just real scary. But at any rate, I guess I'd just like to say I had the flu last week. And I mean, you know, one of those old-fashioned flus that just puts you right down in bed that can't even drag yourself out. And I've got a little residue of that still left. That's why I'm still nasally. But I just think that that's a long way from terminally ill. But I think that's the way we are in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we can go have a cold and be sick for 5 days, and the next thing I know, somebody said I had AIDS. But that's the way we are, you know. I mean, we make a little bitty molehill into a big mountain no matter what it is. But at any rate, I think that I am physically sound. I may not be mentally sound, but I believe that I am physically sound and that everything's okay. So I just wanted to say, hey, folks, I'm not ill. I'd kind of like to start off by talking about my higher power, and because that just kind of helps the butterflies to land, because I never seem to not be nervous when I talk. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that. One of the things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is there just are no negatives in God's world, that everything is a positive. And that's the way God works in my life today. And when I was a little girl, my name is Polly. It's not Pauline or Paula, it's Polly. And with a name like Polly, you get teased a lot. And I just absolutely hated to have the name Polly, because people would call me, you know, like Polly wants a cracker and Polly Wally doodle all the day and all those kind of things. And I just hated to be teased. I couldn't stand it. And I've come to believe that having the name Polly is really a gift, because there's not many Pollys in Alcoholics Anonymous, and when somebody says Polly, I'm pretty sure they're talking to me. When I knew I had the disease of alcoholism, and I didn't know that it was a disease, but I knew that I was an alcoholic. And I thought that that was just a real bad sin, and that only really horrible people were alcoholics, and there was something terribly wrong with you. And I knew that I was going to die from this disease. There was just something inside of me that told me that I was going to die. And I used to drive down the freeways in Dallas, Texas, and just pray to God to have heart disease or cancer or anything. Anything but alcoholism. I just wanted to die of something respectable, because I knew I was going to die. And today I know that the disease of alcoholism is my greatest gift. Because if I didn't have the disease of alcoholism, I wouldn't qualify for the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it is because of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that everything I am or hope to be, I owe to Alcoholics Anonymous. 7 years ago, I married Dave. Dave's last name is Pistol. My name is now Polly Pistol. You know, I just need a couple of tassels and some six guns, you know, and that's the kind of name I have. And you walk around with a name like Polly Pistol, and believe me, that's a load. Because, you know, I call up Sears or Penny's or someplace like that, you know, and I say, this is Polly Pistol. You should hear the person on the other end try to get it together, you know. They can't even talk to me. But by God's grace, and a name like Polly Pistol, I can be laughed at today. And that's a miracle. Because I had such sensitive alcoholic feelings that I never could be laughed at. And you never could tease me, or I'd just walk off and pout somewhere. But thanks to God and this fellowship and Alcoholics Anonymous and all those things, it works. There just are no negatives in God's world. One of the things I'd like to talk about, too, just for a second, is Barbara. I moved to California in 1981. Dave and I moved to California, and I just hardly knew anybody. You know how when you're the new kid on the block and you don't know a lot of people. And we hadn't been here but just about a month, and they were having the Southern California Convention in Bakersfield. And Dave had to go out of town on a business trip. And, you know, of course, I wanted to belong right away and didn't know quite how to do that. And he was going out of town, and I didn't know how to go to Bakersfield, and I didn't know anybody. And this lady says, why don't you come go with me? And you can stay with me, one night, and then you can go stay with Dave. And because of her, I mean, this is like, you know, we've come full circle. That was the very first convention in Bakersfield. And God, here we are up here on a podium. I mean, it's like, wow. But, you know, like, wow, it's like coming a long way, huh? But this is the way this fellowship works. It's just, you know, we just help one another, and you never know what's going to happen. It's just so dynamite. At any rate, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that I should tell in a general way what it used to be like, what happened, and what I'm trying to be like today. And I'm going to try to do that. And I'd like to start off by saying I'm the only child of Southern Baptist faith, and that's probably enough to screw anybody up. So I came into the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of old ideas. I've got a lot of ideas up in my head, and I still have them, that come back from all that Baptist bringing up. And I come from a family, I'm the only child, and one of the things that I was real sure of is that I was very loved. I knew that my parents absolutely adored me. I also knew that there was a lot of craziness that went on in my house. And I do not come from an alcoholic home. The only difference between my dad and I is he just forgot to take a drink. Everything else is the same. His behavior was the same. He just didn't drink alcohol. But I knew that there was a lot of craziness that went on in my house. And I was ashamed for people to come over because I was afraid that they might, you know, see what was going on in my house. I just wanted that to be a big secret. And what would happen is my father had this rage inside of him. And he would be just fine. And my mother and I would never know when this rage would come out in him. And when it would, I mean, he could get so angry, he could pull a door right out of the wall, facing it all. And he would throw furniture, and he would knock my mother around, and he would just scream at the top of his voice. And this used to just terrify me. And I was so terrified of this anger. And it was like what would happen to me as a little girl if it would become my responsibility, or I assumed the responsibility, to start to take care of my mother and comfort her and try to get her calm. And then when that would happen, I would go try to calm my dad down. And it was sort of like I became, in my family, little Miss Fix-It. You know, it was like up to me, so I thought, to take care of my mother and dad and to make sure that everybody was calm and everything got taken care of. And when I would go off to school and kids were doing other things in school, like extra activities or whatever, I didn't want to stay home after school. I wanted to go home because I felt like I had things to do at my house. You didn't know what was going on at my house, and I needed to go home and take care of things. So it was just like I became to assume all this responsibility in this family. And I would look at these two parents, and I would just see this rage in my dad. And I just hated this rage. And I never, ever wanted to be like him. I just thought that it was just so frightening, and I was so afraid of him. And I thought, there's just no way I'll ever be like you. And I became just like him. And I would look at my mother over here, and I would get so disgusted with her because she was just such a wimp. How do you allow anybody to treat you like that? It's just so disgusting. You don't stand up for yourself. And I had no respect for her. And I said, there's just no way I'll ever be like you. And like what happens when we come from homes like this, I became just like her. And when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I realized when I got here, when I was asked to take a look at myself, that I was just an angry wimp. I had been the worst of both. And how that happened is the only people that ever saw my anger was my two little boys. And that's who I would take this rage out on, was these two children. But when I was around my husband or other people, I was just so nice. And this was the kind of person that I was. And I just had this turmoil inside of me all the time and this rage. And then I just couldn't stand up for myself. And I just didn't know what was going on inside of me. And I didn't know how this had happened. And I was so afraid of everything. I was afraid to go to college. I was afraid to go to school. I was just terrified of everything. Yet, on the other hand, I felt so responsible. I felt like I was the one who was keeping this family together. I was the one who was taking care of everyone. It was just all this confusion inside of me and these feelings that I just didn't know what to do with. And I would just get so wound up that sometimes I felt like I was just going crazy. And I had this self-worth inside that I just didn't understand. I felt like I was just nothing. I had, as a young girl, I had zits all over my face, and I just felt like I was so ugly, and I just, you know, I couldn't stand it, and I was real skinny, and nobody's going to like me, and there was just nothing about me that I felt like was any value, nothing within myself, and these were the feelings that I had. When I was about 13 years old, I started having migraine headaches. And back in the olden days when I had migraine headaches, my mom was a nurse, and what they did for that was Demerol. Now, I don't know if there's any Demerol addicts in here, but I'm here to tell you one shot of Demerol, and I thought I had died and gone to heaven. It was wonderful. And I loved it. You know, it was like zero responsibility, and you just sort of float off into, you know, into Never Never Land. So what I did from the age of 13 to 17 is I had marvelous performances. I had the best headaches you ever saw in order to get these Demerol shots. And at the age of 17, I found alcohol, and it just was a whole lot less trouble to feel the same way. And at the age of 18, I married an Air Force officer. And here this person who just feels like I had all this responsibility, the truth was is that I wanted no responsibility. I wanted someone to take care of me. And I just knew that this man was going to take care of me and that we were just going to, you know, just ride off into happy destiny. Well, lo and behold, this man was a SAC pilot for the Air Force. And it was amazing. The Air Force wanted him to work a lot. And they wanted him to go off for months at a time, years at a time. And, you know, I'm just thinking, well, who's going to take care of me and these two kids? Because now, shortly after, 2 years after we're married, or 3 years, we have two children. And it's like, my God, I have all this responsibility. And the truth was, I wanted no responsibility. I just wanted somebody to take care of me. And, of course, if you're in the Air Force, it was like drinking was a way of life. It was Bloody Marys in the morning, sherry at noon, martinis before dinner, Black Russians and Stingers after. It was just a way of life. Everybody did it. And it never occurred to me that any of us were drinking too much. And then we got stationed in lovely places like Caribou, Maine, and Plattsburgh, New York, you know, where it's like, you know, 200 degrees below zero and 300 feet of snow. And, of course, that's an exaggeration. But, you know, if you lived in places like that, you'd drink, too. And, you know, and I had all these little, you know, I had these two little kids that were making me crazy because I didn't know what to do with them. If they didn't behave just right, they made me nuts. And I just didn't know what to do with them. So the next thing I'm at is I'm at a military doctor because I'm real nervous. And, of course, he tells me to take these because, by all means, don't upset the jock. We don't want him upset, so you stay calm. So from 1962 till I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1977, I went on a whirlwind of Valium, Librium, Seconal, Numitol, and booze. And I never took one of those without the other. It was always the combination of the drugs and the alcohol. And when you take those kind of drugs, I'm married to a speed freak. I cannot possibly imagine why people drink booze and take speed and go around and vibrate. You know, that just doesn't make any sense to me at all. I just don't understand it. All I wanted to do was just get out. And there's a lady out in the desert. She says that she believes there's two kinds of alcoholics, those who want to get in and those who want to get out. And all I wanted to do was just get out. I wasn't a party girl. In case you didn't, and you missed the accent, I'm southern born. And when you're southern born, you're always a lady. You know, whenever you go out, it's like my, you know, when my mother, when we went outside, I don't care what kind of craziness had gone on in our house the night before, you walked out of that front door with a smile on your face. And everything was wonderful. And ladies were ladies. And I didn't drink in bars. I drank at the officers' club. But that was the extent of my going out and partying. And I was married to an Air Force officer, and there's no way that I could ruin his bad name by my misbehaving. So, you know, it was just always that I was just so nice. But it was when I would get home, and I would do this thing in secret in my house. No one else but my family saw this. So there's not a lot of stories to tell about my drinking. You know, it's like that's about all you're going to hear, because if I don't tell you any more about my drinking, we're all going to go to sleep. I'm a constipated alcoholic. If you take those kind of drugs and drink booze like I did, you're not conscious a lot. I was unconscious a lot, and that was my goal in life, is to take pills and drink to go out. I looked to pass out. I was not looking to have a good time, because the way I saw it, when you were out in public, you couldn't have a good time. You had to look good. You're not going out to have a good time. You had to look right and look good. That's the way I was brought up. And by all means, if you follow this bringing up by marrying an Air Force officer, you sure enough always have to look right. So it just never occurred to me to do any of this stuff except at home. So what happened was, is I had these two little boys, and their father is gone all the time, and their mother is passed out on the sofa. And if ever I believe with all my heart that this disease is a family disease, I believe that. Because my drinking caused my boys a lot of heartache. Because what happened is these children lived in total neglect. Their mother was never present, she was always unconscious, and their father was gone. If anything, those children ended up doing for me the same thing I had done for my mother, which was take care of me. My little bitty children were taking care of me because I was the one passed out on the sofa. I just, you know, there's still a lot of heartache about that, because I know that this disease is so far-reaching. But the thing about it is because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and because I'm sober today, I am the example and the mom today that I always wanted to be. I never could be the kind of mom I wanted to be. It's like I had an idea of what a good mom ought to be, but I just never could get off the sofa to be that kind of mom. And so today I feel like, you know, thanks to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I can be that example. At any rate, that's all the drunkologue I'm going to talk about, but I want to tell you some incidents that brought me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. One night I was passed out on my sofa. If it was evening, I was always passed out on my sofa. And my husband jerked me up, and he sat me at the kitchen table, and he said, alcohol and pills are our problem. If you just didn't drink and you just didn't take pills, everything would be okay. And I just sort of looked at him as he had sat me there, you know, in my sort of semi-comatose condition, as he poured out the pills and he poured out the booze, and just sort of watched him. And when he was all done, you know, screaming and yelling, I went and laid back down. Now, I had reached a place in my disease where I ceased to wake up or go to sleep. I just came to and passed out. And that night, I came to, and when I came to, I was really sick. Now, I'd also taken to drinking things like NyQuil cough medicine and vanilla extract. I was a real estate salesman, and in my keen alcoholic thinking, I thought, if you can't smell me, you can't tell me. I thought alcoholism or drinking had to do with smell. I didn't realize it had anything to do with behavior. I just felt like if you didn't smell bad, then nobody could tell you were drinking. So I had started drinking things like that. And it's the same thing I do today. Back in those days, I read labels to see how much alcohol was in something. I do that today for different reasons. I do it today because I don't want to take anything with alcohol in it. But then I would read labels to see how much alcohol something had in it. And NyQuil cough medicine was great booze. I mean, it was just wonderful. So what I would do is I would just drink cough medicine. And so this morning, about 3 o'clock in the morning, I come to, and I'm so sick, I don't even think that I can drive to the 7-Eleven to get a bottle of NyQuil. And that night, I found myself where the big book talks about the dilemma of the alcoholic, where to drink is to die and where not to drink is to die. Because I knew that if I didn't get a drink of alcohol, that I would surely die. And I found myself that night crawling through my garage floor, going through the plastic bags, turning up those bottles just to get one drop. I absolutely had to drink to live. And that night, my husband caught me downing a bottle of rubbing alcohol. I had to drink to live. And I managed to make it to the hospital for a stomach pump that time. I had a couple of car wrecks with my two young sons. And they were not bad car wrecks, just car wrecks. But the last car wreck that I had would bring me to treatment for the first time. And I totaled an automobile in Irving, Texas. And I ran into a bridge abutment. And I'm a blackout drinker, so just to make a long story short, I somehow got out of my car and walked around and got to a phone booth and called the police to report my car stolen. And how much ever time had passed, I don't know. But here come the police and my husband. And so we go to the Irving police station, and we're sitting there, and I get to see that look in the non-alcoholic's eyes that just doesn't understand why we do the things we do. And with so much disgust, this man looked at my husband, and he said, "Why don't you just take her home and sober her up?" And on the way back home, he said to me, "Polly, there's a hospital not far from our house." And he said, "And I wish you would go." And that night I checked into treatment for the first time. And this was a 7-day detox with an outpatient program. And I went in there, and I really did like what I saw. I liked the smiles on your faces, and I liked your happiness, and I thought that all that was great. But there was just something down inside of me that just said, people like me just don't become alcoholics. And while I was in this treatment center, we have what we call in Texas jitter house romances. You know, where sick falls in love with sick and you walk off into happy destiny. And there was this guy in this treatment center, and you know, and I, we'd sit around the tables and we'd talk about how bad they are, you know, those folks. And I would talk about how bad they are. And, you know, he would say, "Well, boy, if people treated me like that, I'd drink too." And, you know, I was looking all my life for somebody to co-sign my bullshit, you know, and here he was. It was great. So at any rate, we leave this treatment center and we walk off into happy destiny for 58 days. And in 58 days, I was 12-stepped by the man that would become my AA sponsor in Texas. And I was 12-stepped out of a motel in Euless, Texas. And I was brought back into that treatment center more dead than alive. And I had been beaten up and numerous and sundry other things. And I knew then that sobriety was my problem. There was absolutely no way that I could live sober. I couldn't live with the feelings of being sober. I knew that there was no way that I could be sober. And I also knew that there was no way I could be drunk anymore. I just couldn't stand to live inside my own skin. There was just nothing there for me anymore. And I just felt like, if I stay sober, I can't live with the kind of mother I've become. And I can't live with the kind of wife I've become and the kind of daughter I've become. I just couldn't stand the person that I had become. And I just knew that I couldn't live with that anymore. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about incomprehensible demoralization. And I had reached that place of incomprehensible demoralization. And how am I going to live with what happened in that motel? I just couldn't live inside my own skin. And I just made a promise to myself that I would be a model patient and I would leave this treatment center, but I just couldn't live anymore. And that's what I did. And everybody thought I was doing so good. And I left that treatment center and I went and got a bottle of Librium, still able to get that Air Force medicine, and a bottle of scotch, and I checked into a motel. Now, I don't believe that there's anybody in this room that doesn't have an Eskimo in your life. Somebody that leads us to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Maybe it's somebody who talks to us through a TV. Anything, but just something that plants that seed down inside of us that leads us to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had such a lady in my life. She knew absolutely nothing about the disease of alcoholism, but she loved me. And that day she said something came over her. See, today I know what that something is. That was God, as I understand Him, working in my life through her. Because she said she got in her car and she knew that she had to find me. And she started driving around until she found my car parked outside this motel. And I hadn't shut the door all the way. It was on a half latch. And she pushed that door open and she found me there. And on April the 11th of 1977, she called the paramedics and they took me to a hospital and I was pronounced dead on arrival. You know, needless to say, that didn't take because I'm standing here today. But I need to tell you about the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I used to sit in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we all go to the meeting after the meeting. We all have, you know, this, can you top this story? Because everybody's got these stories that happen in Alcoholics Anonymous and all this crazy stuff we do. Well, if all you did was lay on the sofa, you know, and watch soap operas and listen to Joan Baez sing the blues, you don't have a lot to talk about. And I didn't have a lot. I didn't have a story, can you top this story? I didn't even get a DUI. I never was arrested. I mean, I didn't even get slapped on my hands good at work. None of those things had happened to me. So my can you top this story was I was pronounced dead on arrival. And I had about that much feeling behind it. And I understand what Tom was talking about last night when he says that he sat in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for 5 years before he began to feel that power greater than himself. Because that's what I did. I sat in rooms and, you know, I just never could get that feeling. You know, you talk about God loves you and you're God's kid. And I just never could get that feeling. But what I did, the thing that I did for 5 years was I suited up and showed up. And when people said get active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I got active. I was on H&I panels. I was picking up coffee cups. I was busy in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I still couldn't get that feeling. And somewhere along about 5 years sober, I'm sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that feeling begins to come over me. And that wonderful, warm feeling begins to happen. And you know, I had sat in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and you told me that I was God's child and that God loves me. And the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is I stand behind this podium today and I believe it. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says the main object of this book is to find a power greater than yourself. And by God's grace in a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and through you and your love, I have found a power greater than myself. And I am so grateful because I sat all those years in all those Baptist Sunday schools and I never could feel it. All I ever felt was less than. But you just said, stick around. And if you're new here today, what I'd just like to say to you is just please, please, please don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle. If you don't have that feeling yet, if that feeling hasn't come over you, just suit up and show up and pick up the cups. And someday it will happen. Some of us get it sooner than others. I sponsor people who are 3 and 4 years sober that are doing what I'm doing at 10 years sober. I'm not a quick study. Some of us just take longer than others. I didn't have this. My husband came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he never wanted to drink again. That didn't happen to me. Those things didn't happen to me. But by God's grace, I just didn't leave. And this program works. This program works. You know, I'd love to say that that's the last drink of alcohol I ever had, but it's not. That night after I left that house, my boss and some of the people that I work with, this lady, took me home with them. And I don't know if you've been around an alcoholic lately that needs a drink, but we're quick. You know, it's like we got to move fast. And I needed a drink really bad. And these folks didn't quite know what to do with me. So the next thing they do is they call this hospital in Arlington, Texas. And I wound up at the psychiatric hospital in Arlington, Texas. And this is Easter Sunday weekend of the year of 1977. And I should have known something was up because these people had keys around their neck. And I checked into this hospital, and the next morning I woke up, and it's Easter Sunday. And I look around that day room, and I think, oh, my God, I'm crazy. But I'm not this kind of crazy. And I'm running up to the nurse's station. I instantly catch the disease of alcoholism. And I said, you know, I really don't belong here. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm sure I belong somewhere else. And the nurse says, honey, it's Easter Sunday, and your psychiatrist won't be here till tomorrow. And sure enough, Monday morning, he comes, and he says, Paula, you're right. You're an alcoholic, and you're a drug addict, and your husband's coming to take you to a hospital in Dallas, Texas. And sure enough, he shows up. And this man had had a monumental dose of Al-Anon overnight. Because he came, and he looked at me, and he says, Paula, it'll be real nice if you enter this hospital voluntarily. But if you don't, it really doesn't matter, because I have a piece of paper here signed by a Fort Worth judge that says you're going anyway. And people like me, who don't become alcoholics, had just been court committed to treatment. And my papers read that I was a detriment to myself and others. And so in my keen alcoholic thinking, I look at him and I say, well, if this is the last drink I'm going to have in my whole life, it looks to me like I ought to be able to drink on the way to treatment. And he never said a word. He just pulled into the liquor store, and he bought a bottle of vodka, and he got a cup with ice cubes, and he just handed it to me, and he said, chuck on this. And I don't know about you folks, but the ice cube and the paper cup had gone a long time ago. At any rate, that was April the 11th of 1977, and because of a loving God and a program called Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had to drink since that day. And I stepped off the elevator at Center Hospital, and a beautiful man greeted me, and he took me in his arms, and he says, Paula, come on in, because we're going to love you sober. And if you're new, that's what I'd like to say to you. Just come on in, because we're going to love you sober, because nobody cares where you've been. We just care where you're going. And, you know, I just never did know any kind of love like that, because, you know, these people knew all about me. They knew what I was about. They had, you know, my husband didn't leave out a glory detail. He had told them everything. And so they knew what was going on. And you know what I couldn't believe is, even though I wasn't acting right and I wasn't doing all those right things, these people loved me. And I just didn't know what to do with that. And I wasn't a quick study in this hospital either, because I just never did believe that I could stay sober. I just never knew how you live with those feelings. How do you deal with those feelings when you're sober, when you don't have anything to get rid of them? What do you do with them? I just didn't think I could live with those feelings. And I'd been in treatment for about 2 weeks, and I walked into the day room one day, and Bill and the other counselors were crying, and I couldn't imagine why they were crying. And Bill announced to the group that this would be the last group that went through Center Hospital, that they had lost their funding. And, you know, that's a terrible thing, I think, because they helped a lot of alcoholics. But I know what those words did for me. Because what happened was, I just ran to my room, and I just threw myself across the bed, and I just said, oh, God, help me. I just can't stand it this way anymore. And Bill walked into the room, and he took me in his arms, and he said, "Honey, now we can begin." And, you know, I'd love to stand up here and tell you that I'm such a spiritual giant, that that's the only surrender I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous, and everything's been wonderful ever since. But, of course, you know that that's not true. I heard Chuck talk shortly after I got out of that hospital, and I remember him saying that life is just a sequence of surrenders, but you have to have the first before you can have the second or the third. And today I learn about those surrenders because, you know, Dave and I try to have a spiritual program. We try to give 30 minutes of every day to reading and praying and meditating, and we do this consistently. But, you know, I'm that kind of alcoholic that the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about. I'll rest on my laurels, and I'll become real complacent and do all those things that we talk about. And, you know, just let that gut start to turn and the temples start to throb and that pain come over me. And, you know, and then I'm dusting off my Big Book and reading it, and I'm in the 12 and 12, and I'm reading every kind of spiritual book I can find, and I'm praying on the freeway, and I'm just really calling upon God. And because of this program, I have learned today that what Bill talks about, and as Bill sees it, that pain is the touchstone of all spiritual progress. I know that I grow in this program without pain, but it seems like I grow the most when I'm in pain, because it's at those times that I really, really turn to God. And it's those times that I really turn to my program. I'm on the phone talking to people. I'm on the phone talking to my sponsor, to my friends. It's those times that I really pay attention to what's going on in my spiritual life. And today I just choose to say that those are just the times when God just pays special attention to me and is giving me an opportunity to grow. Because today I've been around long enough that I do truly know that this too will pass. That this too will pass, and from this will come growth. And that I will be a better person because of it. And what that does is that has helped me to stop running from the pain. That's all I ever did was run from the pain. I just never could stand that emotional hurt. I needed those drugs and that alcohol to just keep me from having those feelings. And today I can just do what the Big Book says, and that is just be still and just listen to what you have to say. And I've grown because of it. And for that, I am really grateful. When I left Center Hospital, Bill gave us this little prescription of how to stay sober. And it said, go to a lot of AA meetings and get an AA sponsor and read the Big Book and talk to God. And the last item on there was, never listen to the way a man talks. Just watch the way he walks. And those are the things that I do in Alcoholics Anonymous today. Because, you know, I need to let you know that I can talk a lot better program than I can actually walk. You know, I can stand behind this podium and I can say all kinds of things. But it's what I'm doing out there that makes the difference. You know, if somebody comes to me today and says, how do you get sober? I don't know. Get a broom. I don't know how you were when you first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I couldn't read too good. I couldn't even sit there long enough to read. I was just jumpy. And I just needed to be doing things. And, you know, it's like I can look real good in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I can look like I'm working a program, and I can sound real spiritual. But what is it what I do when I get out there? You know, if I come in here, and I'm just all wonderful, and then I go outside, and I rip off my neighbor, that's not recovery. The big, you know, the 12 steps is I need to practice these principles in all my affairs. I need to do it out there, too. And those are the things that I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I have to be the same kind of person out there in that world that I am in these rooms, and that I can't go out there and, you know, scam on people and lie and cheat. I just can't do that anymore. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous just... The road narrows. The book talks about the road narrows. And you know what I could do last year in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't do this year. the program, as I grow in the spiritual principles of the program with Alcoholics Anonymous, I can't do those things anymore. And some of the things that I've learned of late is a lot about rigorous honesty. I came into the program with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not a thief. And you know, when it talked about honesty, that's what I thought it was talking about, was being a thief. Well, you know, I sat around here and I was just real sanctimonious. You might have needed something to do with that rigorous honesty, but I didn't. Because I didn't steal. But see, what I wasn't aware of is how I stole your emotions and what I did with your emotions, because there was no way that I knew how to be honest. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about manipulation through kindness, and that's me. I was just always so nice that there is absolutely no way that you would have ever been able to know an honest thing that was going on. You know, you'd come up and you'd say, well, Polly, would you like to do such and such? And I would give you, you know, that smile, you know, that fine smile, you know, that we have, and I would say, oh yes, I will do that. And then I'd go sit back in a, you know, in a corner and grumble because I didn't want to do it at all. But I didn't have any idea of how to be honest. I didn't know what to do. And I had begun to start to work on to try to be honest. And my relationships, my friends, my husbands, my children, no one really knew what was really going on inside of me, because I just did not have the capacity to be honest. I just didn't know how to be honest. And the big book talks about rigorous honesty. And I have just started to touch the tip of the iceberg with rigorous honesty. And I'm here to tell you that it is the hardest thing I have ever done in my life. It is absolutely the hardest thing. And what finally got my attention, what, you know, it's like when the pupil's ready, the teacher will appear. My AA sponsor said to me one day, because I was just trying, you know, to work through some of these feelings, and she said to me, she says, you know, Polly, you're a lot of fun, and I'd like to ask you to go places and do things with me, but you always say yes, and I never know if you mean it. I heard it. I heard that. And what I'm trying to do, one day at a time, and it is the hardest thing I've ever done, is to be honest about how I feel. Because the only way that you and I can have any kind of a relationship is if I be honest. Other than that, it's nothing. It is absolutely nothing, and it's purely superficial. And I never, ever knew that. And I am so grateful to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, the thing about it is, if I hadn't stayed 10 years here, I wouldn't even know that. Because it took me 10 years in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to know what the book was talking about. I didn't know what the book was talking about. It took 10 years for me to know what the book was talking about. When I left that treatment center, I started to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got real active in this program. And you know what happened to me is what happens just like it happens in Southern California. You know, I would go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people would stand up behind the program and say, you know, that people who went through treatment did it the easy way, or that treatment's a $10,000 big book, and all these kind of things. And I'm sitting around thinking, oh my God, I didn't even sober up right. You know, and I started to have all these feelings about that. But I know today that I did it exactly the way I was supposed to do it, and that it was okay for me. But when I left that treatment center, I had this feeling inside of me that was just real empty. And I didn't know how to start to fill it up. And I would go to my AA sponsor, and my big, you know, my big one was, nobody understands me. They'll never forgive me. And I was told to get into 12 and 12 and to absolutely burn that 11-step prayer in my brain. That it had absolutely nothing to do with me being understood. It had only to do with me being understanding. It had absolutely nothing to do with me being forgiven. It had only to do with me be forgiving. And it had nothing to do with me being loved. It had only to do with me be loving. And I just didn't understand all those things. And I said, well, how can I possibly love myself? I don't even know how to do that. How can you love yourself? Because to me, I just hated my own gut so bad. And he says, well, when a newcomer walks in that door, you just reach out your hand and you start shaking it. And if you've got 30 more minutes sobriety than he does, you start telling him about that 30 minutes. And if you'll just talk about it enough, and you'll just start sharing your experience, strength, and hope long enough, one of these days, you'll start to feel that about yourself. One of these days, you'll start to see. And you know, I had sat in those Baptist Sunday schools, and I never, ever understood it. Because they kept talking about, whatever you sow, so shall you reap. And you know, I was always waiting for you to do something for me. I didn't realize that the way you do this deal, that it's all a paradox. You know, it's all real crazy from the way, you know, we see it, or the way I saw it. Because, you know, it's like we have to give it away to keep it. And I didn't understand all those things, because the whole time I was just sitting, you know, and I thought I needed to, you know, if I just sat around and thought about it long enough, I'd be able to do it. And you know, now I know today that I can't think my way into good living. I have to live my way into good thinking. I must take the action. And I just never understood that. And I never did understand anything about love. You know, I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had this empty spot inside of me, and I was just, you know, I just was a zero. I just felt like less than nothing, and I needed you to like me, to make me okay. So the next thing I started doing in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is self-destructing through relationships and sex. I want you to just love me to be okay. And I just never realized it had anything to do with the inside out. I just didn't understand that. Because back there somewhere in that southern bringing up and in that Baptist church, I got this idea that if you love yourself, you're conceited. You know, you're all this stuff. And I couldn't conceive of that, because that's wrong. And I just didn't understand. And if I'm out there sowing all this self-hate and self-condemnation, that's what I was getting back. And finally, I started to reach out and put my hand out to a new alcoholic and talk about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one day, it happened. I began to believe and feel that within myself. The miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, it's like Lois told Bill. Bill says, I've talked to hundreds of alcoholics and nobody's sober. But she says, Bill, you haven't had a drink in 6 months. The miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I'd been on this program 2 years, my father died. And the miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is that we loved each other when he died. And he was so proud because I was sober. When I was 3 years sober, I divorced on this program. And I had been married for 22 years. And one of the worst things that had happened to me is that my husband, when we were married 16 years, had been stricken with congestive heart failure. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of our disease. Selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of my disease. Because when this man was diagnosed with congestive heart failure and his prognosis was really poor, the only thought that came over me was, who's going to take care of me and these two kids? Selfishness and self-centeredness. I got sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and somehow began to think, because I'm Little Miss Fix-It, that this man's going to die without me. if I don't take care of him, and if I don't do all these things, of course my behavior is appalling, but somehow or another he needs me to take care of him. And my AA sponsor told me that he wasn't dying of congestive heart failure, I was. So when I was 3 years sober, he and I divorced. And I need to tell you about letting go and let God, because when I let this man go, he married 6 months later to a much younger woman with 3 children, and he's never been happier or healthier. So, you know, so much for what I could do for this man. When I was 3.5 years sober, I had known Dave since I was 6 months sober. And Dave was very much aware of all my extracurricular activities because we were very good friends in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And Dave had moved to Salt Lake City, and I was still living in Texas, and we were friends, and we had had this little AA correspondence and this little AA friendship. And at any rate, Dave came back to Texas, and he said to me, he says, "Polly, I love you, but you need to get something straight. I don't want to have an affair with you. I want to marry you." And you know, it's no place but in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous do things like that happen to people like me. And it's through these kinds of things that I began to learn about unconditional love. See, I didn't know anything about love when I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought love was, you know, if you do this for me, I'll do this for you. I didn't know anything about love being for fun and for free. I didn't know anything about love being an action. You know, I had love and lust and all that kind of stuff all mixed, you know, messed up. I didn't understand what all those feelings were. But I began to learn about love and what love was all about and what this fellowship is about. Because it was here that I began to feel that it doesn't matter what I do. It's that you just love me anyway. You may not like my actions, and they may not, you know, they may be not good at all, but you love me. And I began to learn about that. And now, God as I understand him is the love that is revealed to me in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because it's people here that love us enough to tell us the truth. Because, you know, I'm doing the best I can. And if I'm doing something that's not good for me, I wouldn't be doing it if I knew it wasn't good for me. I'm absolutely doing the best I can. But it's in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that people are willing to get right in your face and right in my face and tell me the truth. Thank God. And to me, that's love. That's the love. And you know, I used to think love was all these flowery words and all these emotions. But you know, if I stand up here at this podium and I tell you that I love you, and then I go outside and I talk behind your back, that's not love. Or if I tell you I love you and I punch you out, you know, 30 minutes later, that's not love. And I am beginning to learn that if I love you, I need to show you I love you. And it's through my actions. You know that old saying, your actions speak so loudly, I can't hear a word you say. It's what I do, not what I say, that's important. You know, Dave and I have a marvelous relationship. In October, we'll be married 7 years. And that's a miracle. I'm so grateful for this relationship because I didn't know how to be married. How do two self-centered alcoholics have a relationship? And I say very carefully. It's very carefully. You know, it's like we both went our own way. But we get a lot of help. Left to me, I don't know how to have a relationship. But what I do is I watch people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who are having relationships that are successful. And I like to hang around these people. And I watch them real close. Ellen and Red don't know how close I watch them, and Bob and Marion don't know how close I'm watching, but I watch these people have a relationship because they have what I want. I want to be here 40 years from now married to the same man. I want to do it that way, and God knows I don't know how to do it. I don't know what's good for me, and I certainly don't know how to have a relationship. But it's through this program and watching other people and somewhere along the line to begin to follow directions and go get all the help I can get. Go to couples meetings and couples retreats and be willing to risk and share all that icky stuff. You know, and it works. And you know, if it weren't for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd probably be flying around there self-destructing one more time, because all I was looking for is something to fix me, and I just didn't know that it was an inside job. I'm so grateful for this program, and I'm so grateful for the things that I've had. I want to talk a little bit about my two kids. I just didn't think I could stay sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because I could see the destruction that was going on in these two children's lives. I got sober, and my youngest son was 14, and my oldest son was 16. And when I finally cleared out my head, I looked around, and I realized that my 14-year-old was a full-blown drug addict. And I'm walking around saying, God, this isn't fair. It just isn't fair. You know, I'm sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. How could this be happening? And it was in rooms like this and people like you that they just kept saying to me, Polly, you just keep doing what you're doing because you may be the only big book that boy ever reads. And when I was 5 years sober, no, I was 4 years sober, my oldest son married a practicing alcoholic. 10 years his senior. He just went out and married his drunk mother. This child is the one that had taken care of me. The child that had taken care of me like I had taken care of my mother. And I had said many times in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd been overpaid if I just never had to look at the fear in his eyes again. But many a night I'd be passed out on the sofa, and this kid would shake me and shake me and say, Mom, are you dead? Are you dead? And I'd come to, and I'd look into that face. And there was just never such fear in that face. And you know, I've been overpaid in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous if I never, ever have to look into anybody's face with that kind of fear because of something I'm doing. And I feel that way because this child was terrified of me and what was happening to me. And he went and married this practicing alcoholic. 2.5 years ago, she got sober. And you know, our Al-Anon folks need one of us to make them feel okay. I learned that, you know, if they're taking care of us, that makes their day, and that makes them feel worthwhile. So Russ, one more time, had no purpose for living. He had no one to take care of, and he had no one to make him feel that he was of any need. And she called me up on the phone, and she told me that Russ had taken a bottle of sleeping pills and had cut his wrist. And you know, I wanted to get on the next thing smoking to Texas because I needed to rescue this son. But it was in rooms like this that the folks said, Polly, you just stay here doing what you're doing, and you let God take care of us. Well, I'm really glad that God's in the business of doing what he's doing, and I just show up at AA meetings. Because God moves west to Sheboygan, Michigan, and I never thought of that. And you know, the neat thing about it is that Russ is willing to get some help today. And he's in Sheboygan, Michigan, and you know there's not an Al-Anon meeting on every street corner like there was in Fort Worth. And he goes to Al-Anon today. And he and that wife were divorced, but because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, they're still friends. And he is engaged to marry another lady in Sheboygan. And you know, and it's working in his life. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the program of Al-Anon is working in our lives. with my youngest son. It'll be 4 years in January. And James called me up on the phone, and he said, "Mom, I want what you have." And 7 years before, he hadn't wanted what I had. 7 years before, I was supposed to attend one of his school functions. And I was getting ready to go, and he said, "Don't you dare show up at my school, because I'm so ashamed of you." And 6.5 years later, he wants what I have. I've been real fortunate because James has been a student. So he comes to California at Christmas time, and his AA birthday is January the 3rd. And I have been privileged to be able to give this kid a cake for the 3 years he's been sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It works. And another miracle that happened with this kid is Memorial Day. I was sitting in an auditorium at the University of Texas, and this kid walked across the stage, and he graduated from the University of Texas with highest honors. The miracle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and how this program works. You know, when I came here, if I'd have made a list of all the things that I wanted in sobriety, I would have never had the courage to ask God to give me the things that He's given me. I would have never had the nerve to ask Him to do these things for me. But because of this program, and because all God wants for me is to be happy, joyous, and free, I have gotten these things. The big book says, left to me, I would have self-destructed. The big book also says, left to me, I would have settled for so much less. I am so glad that I am an alcoholic. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love this fellowship. And everything I am or hope to be, I owe to the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, because the best I could do for me was to be pronounced dead on arrival. When I was sitting in Center Hospital, Bill used to start every day with a poem. And I like to end my AA talks with it, because it's what AA means to me. I sought my God I could not see. I sought my soul eluded me. I sought my brother, and I found all three. Thank you.